Let's go to the final chapter of the unit, which is about the membrane. We can see a little bit of membrane right here in slide one. We've really already talked about this quite a bit. The main infrastructure in a plasma membrane is made up of phospholipid bilayer, right? Now, why does the bilayer form spontaneously without any living thing involved? Why is it that the phospholipids arrange themselves automatically into a bilayer? Because they are amphipathic,
right?
Meaning that each individual phospholipid is polar on one part and nonpolar on the other part. Which of these two parts is polar? The head or the tails? The head is polar. Why is it polar? What does it contain that makes it polar? Phosphate, right, which explains why it's called a phospholipid. Remember, an individual phospholipid is almost like a fat, right? There's a glycerol in that head, which, because it has three carbons, has three connection points. In a fat, or a triglyceride, or a triacylglycerol, all three of those connection points would be with a tail, a fatty acid tail. Instead, only two of them are connected to tails, and the third one is connected to a phosphate, which you don't see in this detail, but it's in that head. That's what makes the head polar. And polar things don't mind being around other polar things, including water. So the heads arrange themselves right next to the water, and the tails are trying to avoid the water. That's why they form the interior of the thickness of the bilayer. And they are nonpolar because what makes them up? What is a fatty acid mainly? What is it? It's a hydrocarbon, exactly. Except for that one end that connects to the glycerol, which before the connection is main, that's a carboxyl group. If you ignore the carboxyl, the whole rest of that fatty acid is hydrocarbon. And hydrocarbons are nonpolar for what reason? Because carbon and hydrogen, the only two atoms involved, have the same electronegativity values, so they equally share their electrons. So they don't want to be around water, and that's why we call not just tails, but nonpolar things in general, hydrophobic chemicals, water-fearing. They don't really fear them, they just don't want to be around polar things, including water. And things that are polar and therefore like to be around water, which is polar, are called hydrophilic, water-loving. But that's, of course, not an entire membrane, right? That gets you started. That's how the first cell-like bags of phospholipids came into existence. But for it to be a living cell, you have to have more involved than just the phospholipids, because you have to be able to get things into and out of the cell that can't pass through that phospholipid bilayer. And that's where proteins come into play in slide two. So these are all membrane-bound proteins, right? Because they are actually part of the membrane. They're tied to the membrane. Now, I say they're tied to, but they are not chemically bonded to the phospholipids. And also importantly, the phospholipids themselves are not chemically bonded to each other. They're all still independent molecules, and they can all slip past each other, change positions. So what is it that keeps the proteins in that thickness of the layer? Well, remember that a polypeptide is a, in essence, it's a string of amino acids, right? That's what the primary structure of the polypeptide is. It refers to just the sequence of amino acids. But because of what the nature of those R groups of the amino acids, it will fold up into a certain shape, right? Before it folds, though, there are certain amino acids in the sequence that are hydrophobic, the nonpolar R group ones. Remember, the amino acids are grouped into different groups. Some of them will be hydrophobic, some of them will be hydrophilic. And when it assumes its overall shape, the hydrophilic amino acids will be here and here, facing the exterior and the interior of the cell, and the hydrophobic ones will be right here, Those hydrophobic ones don't mind being around the hydrophobic tails, but they don't want to be around the water. And the hydrophilic amino acids don't mind being around the water. They don't want to be around the tails. So even though it's not connected by a chemical bond, if something comes along and tries to push it either more outward or more inward, that means you're now going to be exposing some hydrophilic amino acids to this hydrophobic place where the tails are, right? And that's going to be like pushing against a magnet when magnets repel each other. So it'll spring it back into this shape. It's kind of like a buoy just floating there in a sea of phospholipids, all based on hydrophobic or hydrophilic nature. Now, if you take a plasma membrane, which is not just phospholipids, but also the proteins and other things that are embedded in it, and you use a special technique called freeze fracturing, where you get it cold enough so that it basically solidifies it, and then you break them apart, the two layers of phospholipids. That's what's being shown here. You can see that there is polarity to the membrane. And once again, this word does not mean anything about charge. It just means the two sides are different from each other. And what you can see on the actual photographs is that the proteins that are associated with the membrane are more associated with the inner layer of the phospholipid bilayer than the outer layer. That's why there's not nearly as many proteins you can see in this as you can in this. This is taken from inside, that's taken from outside. And that makes sense because not all of these proteins that are membrane-bound proteins are acting as transport proteins. Many of them are. Their job is to help things through the membrane. But there are others that are doing totally different jobs, like anchoring themselves to the cytoskeleton or acting as enzymes. So that's why you have more facing the interior where the stuff is happening. Okay, now to four. I mentioned just a little bit ago that none of these molecules that make up the membrane are actually bonded together, held in place. And all of them, as a sea of individual molecules, can trade places all the time. That is what's known as the fluid mosaic model of the plasma membrane. Now, fluid means able to flow, right? It's able to change shape. What is a mosaic? In art, what is a mosaic? It's a piece of artwork where instead of using paint or whatever, or pencil, you use little pieces of things like glass or tile, and you put a bunch of them on it, and that makes the image, right? Like on a wall, for instance. That's a mosaic. Well, a fluid mosaic is made of a bunch of little pieces that can all move around with respect to each other. That's what makes it fluid. And so that's a good descriptor of the plasma membrane. You have these phospholipids and also the proteins, even though they're not shown here. But an analogy I usually use to describe this is if each phospholipid is like a person with its head, and you look down on a crowd, like if you have an aerial view on New Year's Eve of Times Square, where you have just this huge mass of people, as they're getting drunk throughout the night, they're not standing in one place, right? If you take time-lapse photography, they're going to be in different positions throughout the night, even though it's all one sea of people. That's what these phospholipids are like. And to give you an idea of just how much movement there is, lateral movement, which means phospholipids staying within the same layer but changing places, that happens about 10 to the 7th times per second. That means 10 million times per second that's happening. So the plasma membrane is really, really fluid. The flip-flop, which means one phospholipid going to another layer, that's much more rare. And it makes sense that it's more rare, right? Because for that to happen, you're going to have to temporarily expose that head to the rest of those tails, which it doesn't want to be around. So that's why they usually stay in the same layer. Now, Part B describes membrane fluidity, how much they're able, how loose they are, is really what's an issue here. By looser, I mean even more fluid, less held together like a solid, more liquid. In other words, well, at any given moment, a cell needs the correct looseness or tightness of its membranes. And that changes depending on the conditions. For instance, when it gets really cold, that's going to tend to make everything more solid, right? Tighter, less, more than looser. So a cell should respond by trying to make its membranes looser to make up for that. And just the opposite, if it gets too warm, things get too loose, you want to tighten up the membrane to maintain the proper fluidity. And a way that cells are able to do this is by changing what kind of phospholipids are in the plasma membrane. Remember we said earlier that the membrane is always being getting new membrane from vesicles and then taking away membrane by forming vesicles? Well, that can bring in different types of phospholipids. Not all phospholipids are identical because there are different kinds of fatty acids, which is just the same reason why there are different kinds of fats, right? And do you remember the difference between a saturated fatty acid and a non-saturated fatty acid? What is the difference? Yes, but why does the word saturation or saturated make sense for a saturated fatty acid? Right, they're saturated with hydrogens. By having only single bonds between the carbons in a linear strand of carbons making up the skeleton, that allows the maximum number of hydrogens to take up the other, the holes in the carbons, right? So that makes a nice straight fatty acid, and if you have a bunch of those, they pack together tightly. So if the temperature got too warm, the cell would make more of its phospholipids saturated. This tightens up the membrane more. If the opposite happens, it gets too cold, it wants to loosen it up, it will incorporate phospholipids that are unsaturated to make it looser. By the way, animals also produce cholesterol. I've talked about the importance of cholesterol already, right? It's the precursor to all the steroid hormones. But it's also important, just as cholesterol, by adjusting the membrane fluidity and also, not so much the fluidity as the permeability of the membrane to ions. That can be, the cholesterol basically fills in little gaps. Did you have a question?
Yes. On the end of the cholesterol, there's like a little tiny dot. Is that anything to...
I don't know in this cartoon. It could just mean a functional group off of that those four rings. Because cholesterol is an alcohol. It has a hydroxyl hanging off. All right. Now on to slide five. So I gave you the definition of the fluid mosaic model, which is a nice thing to devise as a concept, but this shows you the results of an experiment to show you that it's actually the truth. It is actually how membranes are. What they did was use a special technique to mark the proteins in a mouse cell and mark in a different way the proteins in a human cell. Okay, so they're separate cells still, but you can tell them apart because they're marked differently. Then you fuse the two together. Since membrane is membrane, it will fuse together if you do use the correct technique. And if the fluid mosaic model were not true, then you would expect these mouse proteins to stay where they are and the human proteins to stay where they are on one side of the cell, right, of this hybrid cell. But if the fluid mosaic is true, then you would expect them to move around, and after some time, you should have both of them mixed all over the hybrid cell, which is exactly what happened. So it's showing you that the prediction corresponding to the hypothesis of there being a fluid mosaic came true, confirming the hypothesis, supporting the hypothesis. Okay, six is a pretty rich picture of a bunch of different things in the area of the plasma membrane. Some of this we've talked about before. You see cytoskeleton, you see extracellular matrix. You also see plasma membrane embedded with membrane-bound proteins. That's all old material at this point, but I didn't yet talk about categories of membrane-bound proteins. There are some proteins that, even though they are part of the membrane, they are attached to the membrane, not chemically, like I've said before, but they're actually connected to the membrane. Some of them are just associated with only one of the two bilayers, or layers of the bilayer. One layer of phospholipids, by the way, is called a monolayer. So the bilayer is two monolayers. Some proteins are associated with just one monolayer or the other, not both, like this one. And notice that those are categorized as peripheral proteins. The periphery is the edge of something. So they're just connected to one edge, one surface, or the other. On the other hand, there are proteins that stick at least partially through the thickness. So they're not associated just with heads on one surface or the other. They're also associated with tails because they go partially through that thickness, at least partially. And those are called integral proteins. Since they go deeper into the thickness of the membrane, they are part of the integrity of the membrane, the overall holding togetherness or the integrity of the membrane. So they're called integral proteins. And the one that is labeled here is certainly an integral protein. But what's not shown is a possibility of a protein going roughly halfway through the thickness. That would also be an integral protein because it's associated with the tails inside. Okay? Some integral proteins, though, are a special case of integral proteins because they stick all the way through the thickness of the bilayer, which is the one that's labeled integral protein here. It is integral, but even more specifically, since it goes all the way through the thickness, it is a transmembrane protein, meaning across the membrane, the entire thickness. And not all proteins are like this, but transport proteins have to be transmembrane proteins, right? Because transport proteins are membrane-bound proteins whose job it is to allow things that can't get through the phospholipid bilayer to get into or out of the cell. They therefore have to go all the way through the thickness, right? Otherwise, it still wouldn't be able to get through. Another, I think I have a picture of that, so I'll just hold off on that. Let's go on to slide 7. Here we have a picture of a transmembrane protein, but it's shown as a ribbon model to remind you that this is all one polypeptide, right? So it's all one sequence of amino acids. But because of the particular R groups that make up that sequence, it folds up and goes back and forth with many alpha helices in a shape that each one of these lengths of alpha helices makes up part of the wall of a hollow tunnel. So this is showing you how just a single polypeptide can have such an elaborate shape that it forms a channel protein, which is just one kind of a transport protein. Transport protein is a general phrase referring to any membrane protein whose job it is to help certain things into or out of the cell through the membrane. Well, channel proteins are one type of transport proteins. Okay? There are two major types of transport proteins. Channel proteins that are actually have a hollow interior, and therefore, as long as that interior is open, things will be able to go through it. And by things, I mean specific things. It's not just anything that can go through even a channel. Even though it's open, there are specific channels that only, for instance, sodium ions can go through and other things can't. So they're specific still. But anyway, channel proteins is one type of transport protein. Another is a carrier protein. And instead of just forming a hollow tunnel, like a channel does, a transport protein operates by changing shape. So whatever the transported particle is that that particular carrier protein works for, if it comes along, it has to temporarily bind to the carrier protein for it to get through. This is yet another example of a ligand, which is the general name for anything that binds to a protein, right? A ligand binding to a protein has what general effect? What does that cause when a ligand binds to a protein? That causes a conformational change, which means a change in the shape of the protein. Well, a carrier protein changes shape in such a way that the thing that bound to it is now placed to the other side of the membrane and then let go. Okay? So it doesn't just go through a hollow part, it interacts with the carrier protein, it gets carried across rather than just let through. Yeah.
Now, can the carrier protein have multiple uses, or does it only have?
It can carry multiple different kinds of particles, for one thing, and it can also carry multiple individual examples of those at the same time. Depends on the specific carrier protein. But those are the two major kinds of transport proteins. Let's look at some other pictures here first, though, before we go on to more transport talk. In slide 8, we can see 6 major function categories for membrane-bound proteins. I said earlier that they're not all transport proteins. There's other functions as well. Well, transport is a major function. So here we see a couple proteins in A that are acting as transport proteins. They're letting things through that can't get through the phospholipid bilayer on their own. In B, we have enzymatic activity. So all enzymes are proteins, remember, and they're acting as catalysts, so they speed up reactions. Most of those enzymes are just not bound to any membrane. They're just free inside the cytoplasm doing their job in there. But some of your enzymes are actually tied to the membrane. And that doesn't make them any different. They're still doing the same job of acting as an enzyme. They just happen to be doing it while they're part of the membrane. So this represents the red thing being a substrate. It gets turned into something else, the product. In C, we have signal transduction. This refers to relaying a message. So I've already talked a little bit in different lectures about chemical signals, right? We talked about drugs being exogenous signals and hormones being endogenous signals and so on. But who can tell me what I said is true about how chemical signals work? No chemical signal can work unless what happens? Yeah.
It has like the same face or whatever connects to the protein.
Yes, but it's the connection part, the binding, that is the necessary. No signal will have any effect until it binds to a receptor that has the right shape for that particular signal. And this is why hormones can be broadcast everywhere the blood takes them, but only certain organs respond because they are the only ones that have the right receptors for that signal. Okay? Well, chemical signals that are hormones come in 2 major chemical categories. Some of them are polar and some of them are nonpolar. Most of them, whether they're polar or nonpolar depends on whether they are made out of amino acids, protein-based, in other words, or whether they're made out of lipids. Most of them are amino acid-based, which makes them polar. Polar things don't want to be around the tails, right? Nonpolar things, which lipids are, the lipid hormones, which include the ones that come from cholesterol, because it's a lipid, those don't mind being around the tails. So those hormones that come from cholesterol, those can slip right through the phospholipid bilayer, and therefore their targets are inside cells and maybe even inside the nucleus, because you can slip through the nucleus just as easily as you can slip through the plasma membrane if you're the right kind of particle. Most hormones, though, can't get through the phospholipid bilayer because they're polar. And therefore, What they do is really just knock on the door. This sector-shaped orange thing called signaling molecule, that represents a hormone that can't get into the cell because it can't get through the membrane. So it has to have a receptor for it to do anything, and therefore the receptor, which is a protein itself, needs to have part of itself at least facing exteriorly. And that's the part that will have the right shape to receive that signal. This is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? Except in this case, the ligand is a signal. Well, the same general consequence happens, though. When the signal binds as a ligand, it changes the shape of the protein that's acting as the receptor. And since this is a transmembrane protein, the shape, the part of the shape that's facing the interior of the cell also changes. And therefore, it's going to interact with other things inside the cell differently from how it would interact with them, if at all, without that signal there. This is how you can have an effect inside the cell without the signal actually entering the cell. And so notice that this would have to be a transmembrane protein also, just like a transport protein has to be. Because if it was an integral protein that only faced the exterior, it would change shape, but the inside of the cell would never know about that, right? Has to change the shape that's facing the interior as well, so it has to stick all the way through. Okay, and then in D, we have cell-to-cell recognition. This is what I mentioned a little bit earlier when I said you have sugars connected to proteins facing outward, and that tells the other cells of your body, I'm one of you. Well, the reason that your other cells are able to recognize those sugars, which are connected to a protein in one cell's membrane, is that the other cell has a protein bound to its membrane that is able to recognize that sugar. So it's a protein here and a protein here. They're both involved in the cell-to-cell recognition. E has intercellular joining, which is very similar to cell-to-cell recognition, except it's not about making sure that it's the right type of cell. This is simply about keeping the two together, which is exactly what's happening in a desmosome. This is just a more cartoon example of a desmosome, for instance, right? Holding the two together. And then finally, you can have attachment of these membrane-bound proteins to proteins outside, part of the matrix, and also attachment to the cytoskeleton inside, which are themselves proteins. This is what I was talking about earlier when I was mentioning strain relief. Things pulling on that will not damage the membrane because they're connected to the cytoskeleton inside, anchoring it in place. Okay, now to 9. I mentioned this earlier too, so it's not strictly speaking new information. We see these vesicles being formed by the rough ER being sent to the cis face of the Golgi, then being repackaged into new vesicles for export out the trans face. And I didn't have a picture to show you, I just was telling you in words. Notice that if the protein, the purple things, are inside the vesicle, then when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, they'll be spilled all the way outside. But if the proteins are actually embedded in the vesicle membrane itself, then when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, they will now be part of the plasma membrane. That's how the cell can increase the amount of proteins that are in the membrane or reverse the process and take them out of the membrane. This happens, for instance, in what's called upregulation or downregulation. Part of drug tolerance, after you've used the same drug for too long, you need more of it to have an effect. And that's because the body responds by taking away receptors. So you need more of it to actually have an effect. But anyway, that's stuff we've already talked about. Just finally get a good picture of it. And that brings us to the three that we've already talked about, right? I've already discussed slide 10, 11, and 12, so we can skip right over those. 13 is a photograph of a single-celled organism that happens to be a eukaryote. It's a protist. Now, protist, kind of a catch-all word. A protist is the name we give to any organism that is a eukaryote, but it is not a plant, an animal, or a fungus. So all eukaryotes that are not one of those three groups are collectively called protists. Anyway, this is not only a protist, not only a unicellular protist, but it is an aquatic protist. Now, what does aquatic mean? Lives in water, but there are two different words we use for living in water, aquatic and marine. What's the difference in those? No, they both mean water. Right, aquatic means fresh water, so ponds and rivers, lakes, not salty. Marine means ocean, salt water. Totally different environments, obviously, in terms of tonicity, right? Well, if this is an aquatic protist, it's living in fresh water. Fresh water would be described as what in terms of tonicity? What kind of environment is fresh water? Yeah. No, it's hypotonic. Right? Because remember the backwardness of this. The hypo, which means below, is really referring to the solutes, not the water, right? Fresh water is very watery. So it has a low solute concentration and it's therefore hypotonic. It's more watery than the cell. Well, this is very similar to a red blood cell that you saw in those pictures last time, because it's just like an animal cell. It has only a plasma membrane and it doesn't have a cell wall exterior to that. But it lives its whole life in a hypotonic environment, which means water is always coming in by osmosis, right? And since it doesn't have a cell wall, that should kill it. It should burst it, right? Just like a red blood cell will be burst. That's called lysis, remember. That's a big deal for something that only has one cell. You don't want to lose the only cell you have. So to prevent it from exploding, the entire lifetime of this cell, it has a pump, more or less a bilge pump, continuously running, kind of like a heart, beating over and over like a heart, only with each beat it forces water out that has come in by osmosis. So it's never going to stop the water coming in. That's always going to happen because of osmosis. But as long as it keeps pumping it out, it won't explode. And that little pump-like organelle is called a contractile vacuole. It's another example of an empty-looking thing. That's why it's called a vacuole. But it's contractile, meaning it can squeeze itself to force the water out. Okay, now let's get back to transport through or into or out of a cell. I already told you the information that's in 14. Transport proteins come in two types. Channel proteins that are open, although channel proteins don't always have to be open. There are some channels that are called non-gated channels. They are just always open. And there are also gated channels that have part of the protein that actually closes or opens up. So they're controllable, obviously. A gated channel is still a channel, but only if the gate is open will it actually operate for transmembrane transport. But anyway, those are just little tunnels. Carrier proteins, on the other hand, only work if the right type of particle temporarily binds, causing a shape change so that it's released onto the other side of the membrane. And that can be used for either inward movement or outward movement. That just depends on the situation. Now, well, if you think back to what I talked about in the lab last time, I said there were three different kinds of transport processes to get things into or out of cells, right? What are those? Active, passive, and vesicular. We've already talked about vesicular transport, so just erase those temporarily from your mind. Just focus on active and passive. What makes the difference there? What's the distinguishing factor?
Active
The need for additional energy. Yeah, remember, passive transport has the energy already built into it, so it doesn't need any extra energy. Active transport requires additional energy from outside of the system if it's ever going to happen. And what do we call passive transport? That operates via what mechanism? It's called diffusion, right? Things diffuse on their own because the source of energy that forces them to diffuse is what? What is the source of energy for diffusion? No, that would make it active transport. Diffusion is always passive. So what is the built-in source of energy? Yeah. The gradient, exactly. Not only for this unit, but for especially for the next, you should keep in mind that gradients are forms of stored energy, and they therefore can pay off to do some work. Well, the payoff in diffusion is that you get to move the thing for free, right? Because the gradient itself is the source of energy, and that moves the particle, whatever type it is, from where it's more highly concentrated to where it's less highly concentrated. And if there's a membrane in between point A and point B, then it might or might not be able to get through it, right? So the gradient being in place is definitely a requirement for there to be diffusion. If there's no gradient, there's not going to be any net diffusion, because there'll be as much movement in one direction as there is in the other, and nothing net. But there are two requirements that a particle needs to fulfill in order to make it through the phospholipid bilayer directly. One of those is that it has to be small enough. If it's too big, it's not going to get through, period. Which is why you have to digest your food to get it into your body. But even if it's small, that's not necessarily enough. For instance, a single proton, which is also called what? It's another name for a proton. What kind? What kind? A hydrogen ion, right? Because hydrogen is just a proton and electron. You lose the electron, all that's left is the proton. It's almost as small as you can get, right? It's even smaller than an atom. So plenty small enough, but it's beyond polar. It's fully charged, right? And that charge is what makes it not want to be around these tails. So it can't get very well through the phospholipid bilayer. Things that can get through have to be small enough, and they have to be nonpolar enough. Now, some things are both small and nonpolar, like oxygen molecules, which is why they will diffuse right through the cells making up your lungs, right through the cells making up the walls of the vessels, right through the membranes making up the walls of the red blood cells, and then finally meet up with hemoglobin. Okay, they diffuse right through the phospholipid bilayer. But then there are the things that the cell needs to get into and out of itself that are either too large or too polar or both. And those require the help of transport proteins. That's why you can't have a plasma membrane being made of just phospholipids. All right? And those, as we've said, can be either a channel or a carrier. Okay, now, for passive transport, diffusion, always passive, a transport protein of either of these types could be used. Assuming that it's not something that can diffuse right through the phospholipid bilayer, it needs a transport protein, right? Well, it could be a channel. That's one way for it to get through, if it's the right kind of channel. Or it could be a carrier protein. Just because a carrier protein involves a binding and a changing of shape does not mean any extra energy is spent. So if the particle is going down its gradient from high concentration to low concentration, then by definition it is diffusion. But if that requires the help of a protein rather than going directly through the phospholipid bilayer, then we call that facilitated diffusion, because the proteins are facilitating or helping out in that process. Okay, we would call it simple diffusion if it can slip right through the phospholipid bilayer. Facilitated diffusion if it involves a transport protein, either a channel or a carrier. But facilitated diffusion, as the phrase indicates, is still diffusion, and therefore it's still passive. That can only happen from high to low concentration. Now consider active transport. Active transport always is only ever going to happen if you supply extra energy. And it can be in the form of ATP, but that's not the only source of energy. Has to be some additional energy spent, though. And that's because active transport moves things against their gradient, the opposite way they want to move. So it takes them from where they're already low concentration and stockpiles them even more in a place where there's higher concentration. The only way that can ever possibly happen is if you physically grab onto them, right? Which is why a channel can only ever operate passively for diffusion, for facilitated diffusion. If you open up a channel, it's always going to come downhill. It's never going to go uphill, right? On the other hand, a carrier protein can be used for passive transport, facilitated diffusion, or for active transport. If you do the reverse of what's shown here and you grab onto them inside and then force them outside to where they're already higher concentration, then that would be active transport, right? Now, the protein is not going to do that on its own. You have to supply energy to do that. But the point is, if it's active transport, then the protein has to be a carrier. It cannot be a channel. And when that carrier protein requires additional energy, and therefore operates for active transport rather than passive, then we call it a pump, by analogy with a water pump, right? You don't have to add any extra energy to get water to go downhill, as the person who lives in the basement knows. But to get it uphill, you have to supply energy and use a pump to do that. Okay, so that's what we see in slide 15. This is just one example of a pump. But for us animals, this is the most prevalent type of pump. We have different kinds of pumps in our bodies. They're all active transporters. That's just another name for a pump. But we have by far more of these than any of the others. This is the sodium-potassium exchange pump that really is two pumps in one because it's simultaneously pumping two different kinds of particles. It pumps sodium ions from the interior to the exterior of the cell. And so it creates a gradient. That's another thing about pumps. Because of the expenditure of energy, you create a gradient rather than allow the gradient to dissipate, which is what diffusion does. Right? You're stockpiling them on one side or the other. So sodiums are taken out of the cell where they're already more rare and put outside where they're already more concentrated, making it even more of a gradient. At the same time, though, it grabs potassium ions from the outside where they're already rare and puts them on the inside where they're already more concentrated. So it moves both of them against their individual gradients. All right? And this is happening in all of your living cells. You have many, many quadrillions of these things throughout your body, which is why about 40% of the reason you eat, 40% of your energy budget goes into just continuously running these things for your lifetime. But you can see how it's happening here. ATP is absolutely required in this case. There has to be some source of energy, and it often is ATP. But without the ATP, there wouldn't be a change of shape that's required to drag these things the opposite way they want to move. But you see, this is a six-step process. So you follow the arrows, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's one cycle. It can do that over and over, but all of these things happen in one cycle, and every time these happen, you have to spend another ATP, which is why it's such a big part of your food budget. Okay, so here in 16, we have a cartoon explaining what I was just talking about a little bit ago. If things are moving down their gradient, then by definition it is passive and it is diffusion. If they're small and nonpolar and get right through the phospholipid, then it's bilayer, then it's simple diffusion. If they're either too big or too polar or both, they require the help of a transport protein, in which case it is facilitated diffusion, and it can use either a channel or a carrier protein. If it's active transport, on the other hand, it's moving things against their gradient, that's always going to require additional energy, and that's going to require a carrier protein. You can't do that with a channel protein because it'll just leak. Just like if you have a barrel full of water, right? That's a gradient, gravitational gradient. You poke a hole in that, you're not going to be able to get water, more water into it, right? It's just going to leak water out down its gradient. Okay, so 17 is another pump. You have these in your body as well. These are called proton pumps because they don't pump sodium or potassium ions. They pump hydrogen ions, which are protons. And in this case, it's pumping it out of the cell at the expense of ATP. So what we see here is a cartoon of what we would just call primary, or we could call primary active transport. But that phrase is rarely used. If we just say active transport, really usually what we mean is primary active transport. But the fact that I say primary active transport could describe this is because there's a different process called secondary active transport that you really have to understand this first in order to understand. So this is primary active transport. The energy, which in this case is ATP, but it's some form of energy, is directly spent to power that pump. So the protons are being moved physically by the pump that is actually directly using the original energy source. And notice that as this continues to happen with the expense of more ATP, you're creating a steeper and steeper gradient because you're stockpiling a higher and higher concentration of protons on one side than the other. And why is that important? What did I tell you about gradients that you should remember? Just a little bit ago. I told you to keep something in mind about gradients for this unit and for the next. They are forms of energy, yes. Each gradient is potential energy, which can have payoff. If you think about it in the macroscopic world, you can spend energy hauling buckets of water uphill, right? It's not going to happen on its own. You have to put in effort to do that, right? But if you do that, you're creating a gravitational gradient for that water. It wants to come back downhill. That's the tendency that the gradient creates, right? And if you devise a water wheel so that when you spill that water back downhill, it turns the wheel, then the wheel can grind your corn or whatever, do some work for you. That's the payoff of a gradient. Well, pumps don't do this just to create a gradient, just for the hell of it. When a gradient is established by a pump, that means the energy that was originally the ATP or whatever other form of energy powers the pump, now that energy has been transformed into the form of a gradient. And it can do some work for you. Okay? In this case, protons, the things that are being pumped, are kind of locked outside because of what I said earlier. They're small, but they're fully charged, so they can't get right through the phospholipid bilayer. So they're locked outside, but really want to come in down their gradient. Yeah, they just can't. Remember that for actual diffusion to happen, two things have to be fulfilled. You have to have a gradient in place, and there has to be a way to get from point A to point B. In this case, there isn't a way to get from point A to point B, so the gradient is maintained. That's primary active transport. Now on 18, we have this same exact pump, but now we can see that right next door to it, in the next sliver of plasma membrane, is a totally different protein acting as a totally different pump. By the way, before I describe this, let me give you a couple more definitions. There are uniporters. Those are transport proteins that transport one type of particle at a time. And there are symporters. Sim means together. Actually, let me give you another word between these two. There's uniporters and there are co-transporters. Uniporter transports one type of thing. A co-transporter transports two different types of things, two different types of particles. But there are two types of co-transporters. There are symporters that are co-transporters that move both of those different things in the same direction. So it moves them both into the cell or moves them both out of the cell. They go the same direction. And then there are co-transporters called antiporters. The two different things that are moved by an antiporter are moved in opposite directions. So one comes into the cell, the other one goes out. The sodium-potassium exchange pump that we already looked at, that's an example of an antiporter. Because it moves sodium in one direction, potassium in the other. Well, here we have a co-transporter that's acting as a symporter. Because it's moving two different things in the same direction. Sucrose, which is table sugar, a disaccharide, and hydrogen ions. Now, this thing is called, sucrose proton co-transporter is an example of a transport protein being used for what we call secondary active transport. We just went through primary, right? Primary active transport directly uses the original energy to establish the gradient. This other one is active transport, though, because it's moving something against its gradient. You can't really tell it by the way it's drawn, but there's already a high concentration of sucrose in the cell, low concentration outside. And it's taking it more from outside where it's rare and stockpiling it inside. So it's moving sucrose against its gradient, correct? Therefore, it's pumping it. Active transport. That requires additional energy, right? No ATP is being spent here, though. So what is the source of energy? Additional energy. Yeah.
The gradient.
The gradient for protons. That's the payoff. Okay, so you spend the ATP to establish the proton gradient. That's using this pump. Now with the gradient of protons in place, the protons want to come back in but can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. The only places that they can come through are this specialized protein that allows the protons to diffuse back in. They're passively diffusing, right? All diffusion is passive. But every time they do that, a sucrose gets dragged along for the ride, and it gets dragged against its gradient. So the diffusion of protons is what powers the active transport of sucrose. And therefore, it is secondary active transport because you first use the original energy source to establish a gradient, and then you use the gradient to pump something else. Is that clear? Secondary active transport confuses a lot of people compared to primary, but you see why, how they're different? Okay, you just saying that, or are you going to be confident in your ability to know the difference? Because this is your last chance, but this is the last meeting before Monday's test. Yeah.
So with primary active transport, it uses the
ATP or other source of original energy.
Right, and then the secondary, does that bring it back in?
And not the ATP.
Not the ATP, but by using diffusion gradient.
Yes.
It takes that energy from gradient to bring it back in.
Right. The protons are like the water in my example. You use your effort to drag it uphill. Here you're using the ATP to drag it the way it does not want to go. And then once that's in place, you let it come back down, like the water spilling back downhill, but only in a specialized place, like a water wheel that will do some work for you. Here it's a co-transporter that when the protons diffuse back into the cell through them, they drag sucrose against their gradient into the cell. Yeah?
So rather than looking at primary transport secondary as a continuation of primary, you could say that primary, you want to emphasize on the ATP part, the extra energy it's using, and then secondary is the diffusion.
That's right. The secondary active transport uses a gradient as its source of energy, but the gradient wouldn't exist unless you had primary active transport using some other energy source to create the gradient to begin with.
So you do kind of use that continuation.
It is a continuation, yeah. If you shut down the proton pump, this will no longer work.
Yep.
Because eventually enough protons come in that there's no longer a gradient, and they're no longer going to drag any more sucrose in. Now we can get back to vesicular transport that I told you ignore temporarily. We've already kind of talked about this in using other pictures, but remember that vesicular transport is a real general term because it just refers to any transport involving vesicles, right? What are the two subdivisions of vesicular transport based on the direction of the transport? Endocytosis and exocytosis, correct. Endocytosis is inward vesicular transport. Exocytosis is outward vesicular transport. And then you can also subdivide endocytosis into two, depending on the nature of what's taken in, right? What are those two terms? What is endocytosis of solid particles? That's phagocytosis, that's the cell eating. That's what's shown at the top. That big brown chunk, whatever it is solid. So it's being phagocytized, and cells that do that are called phagocytes for that reason. But the same exact thing can happen to just a little liquid sample from the exterior, taking a little sip from the liquid. You're still forming a vesicle the same way. It's just it's liquid instead of solid, so we call that pinocytosis, self-drinking. And then the third one, which I didn't mention in lecture today because the picture wasn't there, is just a special case of endocytosis called receptor-mediated endocytosis. Well, if it's not receptor-mediated like the top two, then the cell is basically more or less continuously bringing in these vesicles, taking samples of the exterior. But with receptor-mediated endocytosis, the vesicles do not form unless the right stuff is there in the exterior, which are recognized by these red proteins acting as receptors. So if the right kind of particle is out there, they'll bind to the receptor, and that will serve as a signal to the cell, okay, it's here now, and that will cause the vesicle to form, bringing it in. Yeah?
So what happens to the leftovers that...
Leftover what? The receptors?
Yeah.
They'll be recycled and they can be put via a vesicle back into the plasma membrane. That's how they got there to begin with, after all. Looks like we're done with those lectures.